time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Dar Jamail. Dar Jamail is an independent journalist who writes regularly for the Interpress Service, Le Monde Diplomatique, and the Asia Times. His dispatches have also been published in The Nation, The Sunday Herald of Scotland, Al Jazeera, The Guardian, Foreign Policy and Focus, and The Independent. His reporting has earned him numerous awards, including the 2008 Martha Gellhorn Award for Journalism, the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism, the Joe A. Calloway Award for Civic Courage, and four Project Censored Awards. He spent a total of 8 months in occupied Iraq as one of the only U.S. independent journalists in the country, and also has reported from Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. He is the author of the book Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, and he is here to talk about his new book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. Dar, thank you very much for coming in and spending time again with us this morning.
Great to be with you again, Mike.
Start out and tell us, what was your motivation in writing your new book, The Will to Resist?
It actually happened to me. I can't say it was something I actively pursued, had this idea, hey, I'm going to just go write a book about resistance in the military, because I didn't really know of hardly any resistance in the military against both these occupations until I actually was on book tour for my first book, Beyond the Green Zone. And I was going around the country giving talks, and I started meeting more and more veterans who were coming to the talks. And as usual, when I run into someone who's been in Iraq, I ask them, you know, where were you? What time? You know, what was it like? What was going on for you? And with the soldiers, I started talking with them, and I met this guy, Eli Wright. He was a corporal in the U.S. Army, and he was in Iraq. And he said, well, morale was very low. We were, for example, we were getting people straight from Afghanistan sent into our unit with no breaks. And, you know, and then there we were with this, you know, not clearly defined mission, and morale was bad, and we were all depressed and didn't see the point in what we were doing, and why were we there, and how much longer would we be there. And so we decided it didn't make sense for us to be driving around waiting to get blown up by roadside bombs. And so he said what we would do is we would drive out to the end of our patrol route, find a nice big open field, park our Humvees, and then call in a base every hour and say, yeah, we're still searching the field for weapons caches. We'll talk to you in an hour. And then we would smoke cigarettes, drink soda, listen to our iPods, and pretend. And so they were calling these search and avoid missions as opposed to search and destroy, which is a moniker picked up or carried over from the Vietnam War. When, you know, for example, we had a GI resistance movement in Vietnam where by the end of that war, just about half the troops on the ground literally wouldn't follow orders. And while we don't have anything anywhere near along those lines today, because we don't have the organization, we don't have the leadership, we certainly don't have the civilian population in massive support of that movement like we did in Vietnam, at least not yet, we do have actually a very, very surprising amount of resistance in the military, due primarily because we have these two ongoing occupations that really don't have an end in sight. But what I found is the deeper I dug and the more soldiers I met, the more resistance I was finding. Search and avoid missions, for example, are extremely common. And just about everyone I talked to about it, if they weren't actively doing them themselves, they certainly knew other platoons that were engaged in them.
So, and have you seen an increase in the amount of soldiers, military personnel resisting since the Obama administration has come into power and basically continued and ratcheted up the U.S. wars there?
Indeed, we were already seeing an increase in the period leading up to the last election. For example, between 2006 and 2007 in the Army, we saw a 42% increase in the number of troops going AWOL, absent without leave. We're looking at now, on average, in the last couple of years, about 10,000 people a year from all branches of the military going AWOL. And since Obama took office, we're actually seeing this escalate, because his taking office meant an immediate escalation, massive escalation in the war of Afghanistan, where he immediately started sending in 21,000 more American troops there. So that, for example, back in 2002, the U.S. had about 6,000 troops in Afghanistan. It was either 6,000 or 8,000. Now, by the end of this year, the U.S. will have 69,000 troops. And we're looking at sometime within the next probably week, maximum two, we're going to see a military asking the Obama administration for somewhere between probably 20,000 and 40,000 more American troops for Afghanistan. So with all of this happening, people going over there, consequently, the massive escalation means a massive escalation in violence against occupation forces as well. So we saw in July more Americans killed in Afghanistan than any other month of the entire occupation of almost eight years now, only to be surpassed by August, which was another record of Americans killed in Afghanistan. And while this month that we're in now is probably not going to be a record, we're still looking at a massive number of Americans killed there. This is certainly the bloodiest September of all the September so far in the 8 years of this occupation. So troops, people in the military look at this and then they start to resist. They say, look, I don't want to go there. For example, there's a group called Courage to Resist down in Oakland that I spoke with them a couple of months ago, and they said, look, since Obama took office, we've seen a 200% increase in the number of troops calling us for help, because this is a group that does advocacy for soldiers who are refusing publicly refusing deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. They do things like get them lawyers, rally media behind them, get them moral support, put them in touch with other soldiers, and that group alone has seen a 200% increase just since Obama took office.
And do you get a sense from groups like that they're feeling somewhat betrayed by the Obama administration increasing troops into Afghanistan?
Well, I think, you know, groups like that are this one specifically, they're not they're very politically savvy. It was founded by a guy named Jeff Patterson, who was the first conscientious objector to the 91 Gulf War, a former Marine himself, and very politically astute. And so they're not surprised. I mean, you know, they like many of us who read U.S. policy and understand that it's not about the administration, it's about what is U.S. foreign policy, something that doesn't change, whatever the administration is, whatever color they are, whatever party they are, whatever, you know, any of that, it just is irrelevant. And so, you know, to see this escalation, to see a continuation in Iraq where we still have, 131,000 troops, really nobody being withdrawn, that number probably to remain the same at least halfway through next year, if not longer than that. You know, these things really aren't a big surprise.
Do you get the sense that it's the Pentagon that is dictating what should be happening in these conflicts to the White House, or is the White House really even have any influence on this?
It's a good question. I think it's easy to argue at this point that the Pentagon is kind of calling the shots. The Pentagon's kind of running the show. I mean, we look at, you know, the Pentagon where, you know, this is a place where just about half of every U.S. taxpayer dollar goes in some form to the military. You know, we spend more money on our military than every other country on the planet combined. So it's every single year that happens. And so this is a very, very strong, powerful bureaucracy and organization that, you know, is pivotal in U.S. foreign policy, because we have the national security strategy of the United States that calls for things like one of our missions is to open markets abroad and bring more developing countries into the mix, into a system that we, of course, control. That is the national security strategy. It's all about economics. That's how they define security in this government. And then, of course, the other arm of that is, how are we going to make that happen? Well, that's by using the U.S. military when necessary. So we have something called the Quadrennial Defense Review Report, which is, it lines out very clearly, this is how the U.S. military is going to be used to A, open markets in other countries, B, control resources in their shipping lanes in other countries and overseas, etc. So, you know, when we look at what is driving policy, certainly the military is a huge part of the engine.
Another contributor to that being the U.S. arms sales, which we just saw recently beat previous records, and U.S., of course, was at the top of the pile there, too.
Right. This is a key element. You know, we have to have, you know, the Boeings, the Lockheed Martins, the Blackwaters, the Diancors, you know, the Halliburtons, all of these companies that one way or another are making enormous profits off of war. And as long as these companies are making the profits that they're making off of war, of course, you know, guess what U.S. foreign policy is going to call for.
All right, so where is the military getting these soldiers? Because we heard during the middle of the war in Iraq that we really didn't have any more to draw on.
Well, and that hasn't changed at all. That's what's been really amazing to me, that, you know, we all remember the John Murthas and the other folks coming up and saying, look, I've been talking to the generals, the military is stretched thin, it's at a breaking point, we can't keep doing this. Well, that really hasn't changed much. For example, what the military there has been doing to bring more soldiers into the mix is, for starters, they've just in 2008, they raised the allowable age from 40 years old, that was the maximum you could be and still join the military, to 42. And that was after they'd raised it the previous year up to from 35 to 40. So we're looking in a very short period of time, they've dramatically increased the allowable age. They've done the same thing with test scores. They've lowered them dramatically on what's allowed. They've done the same thing with people's weight, and they've done the same thing with people with criminal records. And for example, there's 8,000 people in the military now with rap sheets. So you might be serving in Iraq with someone who, for example, got caught robbing a store or convicted of a rape, and then they come in front of a judge, and the judge says, and this isn't new, this happened during Vietnam too, but then the judge says, okay, you can either go to jail and you're going to do this much time, or you can go to the U.S. military. So they go to the military, of course. So we have 8,000 people in the military with rap sheets. We have them actively recruiting white supremacist people, you know, fine upstanding people like this. So that's one way that they're getting more troops. Another extremely disturbing way that they're getting troops, and I actually have a story coming out on this relatively soon, is that the military is, and this isn't news, actually, this part of it, is that they're actually getting people that are already diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, people who are already diagnosed with traumatic brain injury from having roadside bombs go off nearby their patrols, who've served one tour, two tours, three tours, and they're finding these people, and then they're sending these people back to Iraq. In fact, 43,000 troops so far, this is according to the Pentagon, this is an extremely conservative number, 43,000 troops already diagnosed with medical conditions that should prohibit them from being deployed have already been deployed. We're looking now at over 40,000 troops already diagnosed with traumatic brain injury have been redeployed. We have 12% of the troops in Iraq alone and 17% of the troops in Afghanistan serving right now in combat positions that are already on psychotropic medications, things like antidepressants and sleeping medications because their PTSD is so bad. So that's 12% of the troops in Iraq and 17% of the troops in Afghanistan. And this is just the tip of really a nightmarish iceberg of where are they getting these troops, you know. And then, of course, in addition to that, we do have some of the recruiting problems the military was facing have been eliminated by this massive economic downturn, because of course every time there's big problems in the economy, the military does very well because it's the last house on the block, you know, when folks get to choose, well, I either get to work at McDonald's or go join the military.
And then the whole economic thing ties back into the U.S. goals for its foreign policy, which are all actually economic as opposed to we're trying to bring democracy to whomever.
Right.
So, and you had previously covered in your first book talking about, you're just talking about how we're sending in soldiers who have PTSD or on psychotropics, but just average soldiers who hadn't suffered that already, who are put in under these conditions where they are totally conflicted about why they're serving there, and they're jittery, and they're, you know, in a heavily civilian occupied area, and you know, already essentially on the edge. This has got to be just a recipe for disaster, what you're telling me with this addition of further soldiers who have hardcore PTSD.
It is. And then the thing is, these people come back home. And so what happens? You know, I mean, we all are very aware of, you know, the fact that we're still severely suffering the after effects of Vietnam, where Vietnam vets come back home. And one out of four homeless people you see on the streets of this country today are a veteran of some war. We're looking at right now 1,000 veterans a month who are technically under the auspices of getting care from the Veterans Administration. 1,000 of those veterans a month are trying to commit suicide. 18 veterans a day kill themselves in this country, every single day. We're looking, and this is all wars. This is not just Iraq and Afghanistan. The VA actually, as of 2008, over a 250,000 veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan had filed disability claims with the Veterans Administration. We're looking at a really amazing situation where people are coming back with severe psychological problems, with oftentimes severe physical problems, maimed, traumatized, and many of them aren't even trying to get help. And then those that do try to get help are faced with a VA, and again, this hasn't changed since Obama took office. They're faced with a VA that's either unwilling or unable to help them. So they go, for example, and apply for help, and the average wait for someone coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan to get an appointment at the VA is 6 months. So imagine that you have severe PTSD, you're not sleeping, you're grinding your teeth at night, you don't have any help, you haven't been able to get any counseling or medication or anything like this. How are you going to go that 6 months? And then if you appeal, if you file a claim and then it's denied and then you appeal that claim, you get to wait an average of 4.5 years. So again, what happens to these people in the meantime? And then so we look the other direction and we see suicide. And we see in the Army in 2007 set a record of people committing suicide, only to be surpassed in 2008, another record in the Army of people committing suicide, also a record in the Marine Corps that year, by the way. And then right now on this year, we're well on our way to setting yet another record. So these are just some of the, just a few little areas where we can look and see really a total breakdown within the U.S. military.
I know I just saw recently the article in the mainstream media about the military's response to some of this was to have a special class prior to sending troops over to psychically, you know, try and shield them more so that they wouldn't be enduring this when they got home. It seemed like didn't even qualify as a Band-Aid.
Yeah, it's amazing what the military does to deal with these catastrophic problems where, you know, like you said, giving them a class or, you know, I've seen PTSD classes in the military where they like teaching them breathing exercises and things like this. Well, how about this one? How about not sending people into completely bogus occupations built on lies with no end in sight? That might be something that would alleviate a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury in vets. But they do amazing things. It's usually all propaganda in the military when it comes to trying to deal with these massive problems, when the only way to really deal with them is to stop sending people into, you know, wars of aggression based on lies, as both of these are. So we look at, for example, you know, sexual assault in the military. I actually have a full chapter on that in the book too, where, you know, we look at another catastrophic problem in the military, which is, for example, 20% of all female soldiers that are assisted by the Veterans Administration admit to either being raped or sexually assaulted while in the military, 20%. And then another interesting statistic comes from the Pentagon that shows us 80% of all rapes and sexual assaults in the military never go reported. So I wouldn't argue that you can lop those together and say, therefore, 100% of the women in the military get raped and sexually assaulted. But we can safely assume that it's well, well over 20%.
Seth Manzel, who you also feature in your book, had reported here previously that he said that about a third of the males are sexually assaulted in the military.
Yeah, that I haven't seen that statistic, but it wouldn't surprise me because, in fact, I have a story of one woman in the book who talks about being raped by two different soldiers in one night on a base in Iraq. And then when she went in and told the military police about it and was getting some assistance from the criminal investigation division there in the military on the base, she was sitting on the office across from a caseworker, and she said that she looked over and saw a few files on his desk. And, you know, all this guy did was deal with cases of rape and sexual assault. And they were three men. She saw the names, and she said, these are all men. Are you working on these too? He said, yeah, they're all men and they're all Marines.
We're talking with Dar Jamail. He is author of the new book, The Will to Resist: Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. Talk about what the soldiers who are coming back have to endure. Talk about what those who are resisting have to go through. And I know also that you actually got to see a military tribunal. I don't know if you can weave that into the mix.
Yeah, I basically, you know, we've covered pretty well what folks have to deal with when they come back as far as training to get help at the VA, et cetera, and then troops being redeployed. I mean, you know, as of 2006, 50% of the troops in Iraq were on their second tour. And as of 2006, 2007, 25% were on their third or fourth tour. And those numbers are all much, much greater today. About a third of the troops in both occupation are National Guard. So much for the one weekend a month. So, again, you know, you can kind of, that starts coloring in the picture of, so the, what happens when these folks come back home? But more specifically, when troops decide they're going to publicly refuse a deployment to Iraq or Afghanistan, like Aaron Watada did here a few years ago, we've had more examples recently of troops actually refusing combat deployments to Afghanistan. And one of these I want to talk about specifically, Sergeant Travis Bishop. This was a guy who had already served a tour over in Iraq, and he's from Fort Hood, based out of Fort Hood in Killeen, Texas. I think it's the largest base in the country and arguably the most heavily deployed base in the United States. And so he comes back and realizes that because of his spiritual beliefs, he is a conscientious objector. And the military supposedly accommodates a conscientious objectors as a process you go through. You have to prove the authenticity of your beliefs, et cetera, et cetera. And so he decides, you know, I'm not going to go to Afghanistan because I'm opposed to all war. And he'd gotten a lawyer and he'd filed for CO status. And then the military court-martials him. No, there's not going to be enough time. We think you're just trying to get out of this, blah, blah, blah. So they court-martial him. And I actually went to his court-martial. This was about a month ago. And it was really amazing. It's one thing to hear about military court-martials, the fact that over 95% of them result in a conviction. Basically, the decision's already made before the so-called trial even takes place. It's a kangaroo court. Really amazing. I mean, I felt like I might as well have been in the Third Reich or something. One of these kind of bogus trials. Really, really amazing. Of course, the judge is someone in the military. Of course, the jury is all military, and they're all very high-ranking, quote-unquote, lifers in the military. And then you have this little sergeant or private or specialist or whoever it is, and you know, they're basically just watching how they're going to be raked over the coals. And that's basically what happened. So this court-martial occurs, and then Travis Bishop is given a year in jail in a military brig. He forfeits two-thirds of his pay for that year. His rank is reduced from sergeant to private, and then when he's released, he'll be getting, I believe he'll be getting a dishonorable discharge, which is a big black mark then when he tries to go out and get a job. But the thing is that these people, and I actually spoke with Travis Bishop and spent time with him right before the day that he was sentenced and then put in manacles and taken to a van and then taken to a jail, and then now he's actually been transferred and he's in Fort Lewis now. And that, you know, what the military does to these people who are actually following their oath, following international law, following the U.S. Constitution by refusing orders to deploy to an illegal war, a war that contravenes the U.N. Charter, and therefore, by definition of the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution, it's a war that actually means if you're going to deploy as a soldier, you're violating your own U.S. Constitution. So these people that resist are actually holding to the oath they swore as a soldier to support and defend the Constitution more than anyone can imagine. You know, it really turns the whole thing on its head when you look at these resistors and see actually they're abiding by the law more than anyone that's over there following these bogus orders to deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan. But then consequently we see this guy who is really acting on the height of, from the height of patriotism. He's now in Fort Lewis. The first week he was there, the military wouldn't even allow him access to his lawyer, which of course violates the Constitution. But why should this surprise us? Because we have an entire military and government that's violating the Constitution. But here they are very happy to do that at Fort Lewis. They won't let him talk to his attorney. They won't let him add any friends to his friends list. They're setting up all these roadblocks to where, you know, it's making it impossible for him to do anything to lessen the amount of time that he's in Fort Lewis. But the main thing is, here's a military blatantly violating attorney-client privileges in the Sixth Amendment of the Bill of Rights of the U.S. Constitution. The military just flagrantly violating this. And so that's how they're treating these people. So even once they put them in a military brig, as if that's not enough, here at Fort Lewis specifically, they've decided to take it upon themselves to go ahead and continue to violate the U.S. Constitution.
One of the myths that gets continually perpetuated, and I think I have added to that in the past, was the myth that once you sign the contract that you have no rights in the military. Can you talk about that and talk about what organizations are available to those resisting?
Right. That is a very common myth, and I actually believed that as well for a long time. I just thought, well, once you decide to join the military and you sign the dotted line, that's it. Basically, the military owns your butt, and you're going to be following what orders they give you, and that's it. But there's several things that go along with that. I'll just try to be brief and mention a couple of the main ones. One is that if you join the military, and sign the dotted line, you still have rights. You still have the right to a lawyer, both a civilian and a military lawyer. You still have the right to file for conscientious objector status. You still have the right to call your congresspeople. You still have the right to file petitions. You still have the right to question orders. And you have the duty as a soldier to only follow legal orders. It says that in the oath you swear as a soldier. When you swear to support and defend the Constitution, you swear to do that by following lawful orders. So you are duty bound as a soldier to only follow lawful orders. Therefore, you are duty bound as a soldier not to follow unlawful orders. So, for example, if you're in the military and you're in Afghanistan and your sergeant says, hey, run over there, break into that house and just kill anyone in it that you find, and you break, and you know there's a family in there, you are duty bound not to follow that order. So it's the same thing. So you have those rights and you have those moral obligations and legal obligations. So there's several things that by joining the military, you don't basically check your brain at the door. You don't abdicate all your rights. You don't give these up. You, in fact, really, I think, take on more responsibility as a soldier that, this is a very serious business. If I'm going to support and defend the Constitution, I damn well better know what that says. And I damn well better understand that that means that is supporting and defending the ideals of this document, not the diktats of George W. Bush, not the diktats of Barack Obama, and whoever else is going to come next that's going to continue to prosecute these wars of aggression that violate the UN Charter and therefore the U.S. Constitution.
You are in town. You're going to be, I should tell people who you are if they don't know already. We're talking with Dar Jamail. He is author of the new book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you're going to be doing a couple speaking engagements while you're in town tonight at the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility fundraiser, which I think is pretty well booked up. But if people want to inquire about that, they can do so via WPSR's website, WPSR.org. And the second one tomorrow night, at University Temple United, I believe, United Methodist Church at 1415 Northeast 43rd. But that's going to be a fundraiser for a local organization, Coffee Strong. Can you briefly talk about Coffee Strong?
Coffee Strong is one of several now GI resistance coffee houses across the country that are actively supporting resistors. Also, I want to throw in, I failed to remember to mention this in the last question you asked me about. What are some other support organizations? We have Coffee Strong. We have GI Resistance Coffee Houses. We have Military Law Task Force, where folks in the military can find lawyers to help them with questions about problems they might be having in the military if they're going to decide to refuse a deployment. We have the GI Rights Hotline, GIRightsHotline.org. So there's several organizations like this that do exist that can help soldiers, and people can learn all about those by going to a place like Coffee Strong, which is right on the outskirts of Fort Lewis. There are soldiers there, some active duty, some veterans, and also counselors, and people can go in there and get all this information and more.
Very good. Again, talking with Dar Jamail, author of The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Dar, you also have a website as well that people can turn to.
I do. It's dar.org, D-A-H-R.org. And folks can go there and find all the articles that I'm writing on, especially now that pretty much all are focused on resistance in the military as well as what's happening within the military today as a result of both these occupations.
Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure, Mike. Thanks again.
Again, talking with Dar Jamail, author of The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he will be speaking tonight at the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility annual fundraiser. And tomorrow night, Sunday the 27th, 6:30 p.m., at University Temple United Methodist Church, which is located at 1415 Northeast 43rd Street in the U District, right behind the post office, if I remember correctly. And it's a fundraiser for Coffee Strong, the GI Coffee House. And if you missed any of that, you can find out more via his website, dar.org, D-A-H-R.O-R-G.